Organization of Islamic Cooperation agrees to establish a humanitarian trust fund to address the growing economic crisis in Afghanistan. Chilean leftist Gabriel Boric wins the South American country's presidential runoff election. Also coming up, the top US infectious disease expert warns if the current trend of coronavirus infections continues, the country's hospitals will be overwhelmed with patients again. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation has agreed to set up a humanitarian trust fund to alleviate Afghanistan's economic crisis. The country's woes have been aggravated by the freezing of billions of dollars in Afghan assets abroad, particularly by the US after the Taliban takeover in August. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our news review program.
And now it's time for this hour's news review. The organization Islamic Cooperation meets to discuss the situation in Afghanistan in the wake of the Taliban takeover in August. The organization has agreed to establish a humanitarian trust fund to address the growing economic crisis in that country. Well, the fund will be set up under the Islamic Development Bank to channel aid to Afghanistan. And that's according to Pakistan's foreign minister, whose country hosted the OIC meeting. A final statement has stressed the need for allowing Afghanistan access to its financial resources to prevent economic collapse. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, also attended the Islamabad meeting. He called for the formation of an inclusive government in Afghanistan. The economic crisis there has been worsening as billions of dollars in central bank reserves remain frozen. That's happening as the world is not yet recognizing the new Afghan government formed by the Taliban. I'd like to welcome my guest to this news review. Out of Islamabad, Kamran Youssef, and out of Tehran, Masoud Shajadeh, Chairman of Islamic Human Rights Commission. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off with Kamran. Fill us in on this latest situation. Exactly what does this mean now with the OIC coming to this conclusion and deciding that they want to help the Afghanistan nation?
Well, this humanitarian fund that you are talking about is being set up is to plug the gap that currently there in Afghanistan since the Taliban took control of Kabul. No official banking channel are currently operating or available in Afghanistan. So in the absence of such financial system, any country or anyone wanted to help the people of Afghanistan, they cannot do it. So this is one of the reasons that now this trust is being set up under the Islamic Development Bank, which will channel aid and financial assistance to be provided by the member countries to Afghanistan. Also, the Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi, while speaking at a news conference at the conclusion of this OIC conference, said that some of the member countries were reluctant to channel aid through the Taliban government. And that is why this fund is being set up. So this also indicates while member countries of the OIC wanted to help the people of Afghanistan, at this stage, they are not willing to recognize the Taliban rule because the immediate concern of the OIC member states and other countries is to avert the humanitarian catastrophe and the economic collapse, because we heard the UN relief chief speaking at the OIC conference stating that nearly 23 million Afghans are facing acute food shortage. He also quoted a UN development program assessment that by the end of or by the middle of next year, 97% of Afghans could slip below the poverty line if urgent steps are not taken to mitigate their suffering. So against this backdrop, this OIC meeting took place. And now officials are hoping that this will make a positive impact on the ground in Afghanistan?
Well, Masoud, I want to look at, first of all, because we know, I mean, with the funds of the Afghanistan government, they're being frozen by the United States. I want to talk about the legality of that and how basically the so-called international community is doing nothing. Now, you heard Cameron talking about forecasts, the majority of people to be suffering by next year. And it seems like the so-called international community is just sitting, doing nothing, and at the same time have frozen their funds and saying these poor people are suffering. Your assessment of it all?
Absolutely. Marzia, you really touched the actual issue. The issue here is not a natural disaster that we will get people together and banks set up, Muslim banks or Islamic banks, put a sort of a package together to bring aid into Afghanistan. The reality is that this whole crisis has been created out of U.S. brutal occupation and the fact that they destroyed all the infrastructure, and at the end of it, they handed the country back to Taliban, and now they are putting restriction for Afghanistan to get its own resources, its own money, and have access to it. This sort of sanctions by the banking system, which indeed some of the participants from the OIC were saying that they want to continue it because Taliban are in charge, so therefore they don't want to recognize Taliban. I don't know who they want to recognize to help the Afghani people at this very difficult time. So really, unless we remove this sort of bullying by the West, which is being done in Afghanistan and indeed elsewhere, then you know no amount of aid is going to resolve the crisis that Afghanistan is facing. We need to recognize what's the basis of this crisis. We need to recognize what disease is taking place and then find the remedy for it. And no amount of aspirins is going to resolve it. And you know, when it comes to OIC, OIC has been incompetent to do anything. You give me one single issue in the whole life of OIC that OIC have managed to bring a change or support. OIC was created to support Palestinians. It's done nothing as such. I remember a few years ago, I had a private meeting with one of the heads of OIC, one of the main countries, and the president, in a private meeting, turned around and we were discussing the incompetence of OIC, and he referred to OIC as OIC, and he was making fun of it. I mean, the reality is that OIC, if you're going to wait for OIC, we will all die of old age.
Well, thank you both for being with me on this news review. Kamran Youssef in Islamabad, Masoud Shajar, Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission in Tehran. And thank you so much for staying with us for another news review.
Turning to other news now, the Yemeni army says it has targeted several Saudi cities with ballistic missiles and drones in response to the kingdom's fresh airstrikes on Sana'a. Reports say that Saudi Arabia's Jizan airport has suspended flights after the Yemeni army's attacks. Earlier, Saudi warplanes pounded many locations in several provinces. At least 33 air raids hit Ma'rib province alone. Hodeida and Taiz were bombed as well. Still, there are no reports of casualties or damage, but a Yemeni civilian was killed when Saudi forces opened fire across the border in Sada'a province. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies, backed by the United States, launched the war on Yemen 6 years ago to reinstate a friendly regime there. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed in the Saudi-led war and blockade. Sudanese security forces have clashed with post-coup protesters in the capital Khartoum, injuring scores of them. The security forces fired tear gas to disperse the demonstrators who chanted slogans against coup leaders. Rallies are also underway in some other Sudanese cities. They take place on the third anniversary of protests that touched off a popular uprising leading to the ouster of longtime President Omar al-Bashir. Following the October 25 military takeover, civilian leader Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok was arrested but was reinstated on November 21. At least 45 people have been killed and scores more wounded during the previous protests following the putsch. In other news and developing news, official results show leftist Chilean candidate Gabriel Boric has won Sunday's presidential runoff. With over 99% of the ballots counted, Boric has won nearly 56% of the votes. His far-right rival, José Antonio Kast, garnered 44%. He has already conceded defeat and congratulated Boric on the victory in a tweet. Social justice was the main campaign pledge of Boric, whereas Kast was campaigning on law and order. Boric will now take office for a four-year term starting from March next year. The new president will be dealing with some of the big challenges, including high inflation, the pandemic, and social unrest. He will also be in power for a planned referendum on a new constitution that is in the process of being drafted. In the United States, top health officials are urging Americans to get their COVID-19 booster shots amid an outbreak of the Omicron variant of the disease.
Well, I think people just need to be prudent. Clearly, when you travel, there is always a risk of increased infection. That just goes with respiratory illnesses. But if people need to travel and want to travel for the obvious family reasons during this holiday season, if you're vaccinated and you're boosted and you take care when you go into congregate settings like airports to make sure you continually wear your mask, you should be okay. But we are going to see breakthrough infections, Chuck. There's no doubt about that.
Fauci warns that if the current trend of infections continue, hospitals across the U.S. will be overwhelmed with patients again. The Omicron variant has been identified in 43 out of 50 states and is likely to become the dominant strain in the country. The government is scrambling for more vaccinations as over a quarter of the U.S. population has not received a single dose yet. Also, only 40% of eligible Americans have taken their booster shots. The U.S. is the world's worst hit nation by COVID-19, both in terms of its caseload and fatalities. More than 800,000 Americans have already died from the respiratory disease. Colin Campbell is our correspondent in Washington, D.C., and joins us. And now, Colin, welcome. So I guess the risk, and it sounds like a big risk, according to health officials, is that the new variant will bring record numbers of cases again and record numbers of hospitalizations as well.
It's definitely going to put a damper on the holiday season for sure. That's to put it lightly. As we see the number of cases spike within the past week or two, which you just intimated, and I think people are going to be a lot more careful about where they travel to for the holidays. I just got off the phone with a friend of mine who decided that he's going to stay in for the next week or so because people believe to have been exposed to COVID-19, and I'm sure I'm not alone with people who know other people who have contracted or have at least gotten sick from COVID-19. And so through the holidays, expected to see a tapering back of a lot of the usual festivities that we would normally observe. We've already seen this happening in New York City with some of the cancellations of some of the usually annual seasonal shows that people go to the big city for, like the Rockettes, various Broadway shows, so on and so forth. And we're not just seeing this in New York. We're also seeing it in other parts of the country, too, where they've decided to taper down or curtail their usual Hollywood festivities. Of course, this is a big time when people have office parties and things like that as well. Those all have been canceled or at the very least truncated as far as the numbers are concerned. And of course, there is that constant reminder to get vaccinated. We still have people who haven't received their first shot, never mind having their third shot, which of course would be the booster. And this is customary for this time of year to also get a shot. So we're not seeing the numbers of people that health experts would like to see of people getting their second vaccine shots and also their third shot together, which include a booster shot.
All right. Yep. Colin, thank you very much indeed. As always, Colin Campbell there, our correspondent in Washington, D.C. Now thousands of people hit the streets of the Belgian capital to protest against restrictions imposed by the government to contain the coronavirus pandemic. Police estimate that around 3,500 people rallied in Brussels, but organizers have put that number at around 50,000. The protesters were outraged that the rules which came into force in October, the curbs oblige Belgians to show COVID passes to enter restaurants and some other public places. The demonstrators say COVID-safe certificates are discriminatory as they divide vaccinated people from those who have not received the shot. The rally took place amid growing concerns over the spread of the Omicron variant. Belgium has registered around 2 million COVID infections since the start of the pandemic. Erdogan has vowed to control high interest rates and inflation, which are eroding people's purchasing power in the country.
Sooner or later, just as we lowered inflation all the way to 4% when I came to power, we will lower it again, we will make it fall again. But I will not let my citizens, my people, be crushed under interest rates.
Erdogan made the remark during a Turkey-Africa summit in Istanbul. The Turkish president said he has always been against interest rates since becoming to power. Erdogan reiterated, however, that he would raise the minimum wage by 50% next year. Anger has flared up since the Turkish leader called on the central bank to lower interest rates in order to stimulate growth and production as well as boost exports. But the move saw the Turkish lira plummeting about 40% in value against the dollar amid fears of a further devaluation. The currency crisis has pushed many Turks below the official poverty line. Hundreds staged the protests against the government's monetary policy in Ankara and Istanbul at the weekend. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
The handling of the Kabul strike is an ominous sign that while Biden has pledged to review the drone program, a long-standing mechanism for self-exoneration remains entrenched. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jeremy Schill, Ryder. This article is published under the heading The Mysterious Case of Joe Biden and the Future of Drone Wars. Stay tuned for more. At least two of the U.S. airstrikes conducted under Biden have killed civilians, including the now infamous August 29th attack in Kabul, Afghanistan, that killed 10 civilians, seven of them children. While Biden's drone strike data set is tiny, the outcome of his known strikes presents a ghastly civilian death rate. In the case of Afghanistan hits, 100% of the victims were civilians. So what is happening? Why has Biden apparently decided to pump the brakes on a two-law war that he and President Barack Obama embraced so enthusiastically? For nearly a year, the Biden administration has been engaged in a comprehensive review of the use of drone strikes as a part of a broader evaluation of counterterrorism policy that is expected to be completed later this year or at some point in early 2022. I think the White House is appropriately wary about drone strikes, said Rosa Brooks, a former Obama administration official who worked for the Pentagon as counselor to the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy from 2009 to 2011. My sense is that they're serious about the review and are trying to minimize drone strikes, at least until there is complete clarity on internal policies, she added. Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, did away with most of the rules the Obama administration had crafted in what Obama characterized as an effort to increase transparency, reduce civilian deaths, and establish guidelines that could give some sense of legitimacy to what was, in reality, an assassination program. Biden could have stopped at rescinding Trump's reversals and then resumed the course of regular drone strikes according to the rules developed primarily in Obama's second term. But he didn't. Instead, on the day of Biden's inauguration, his national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, quietly issued an order to roll back Trump's loosening of rules surrounding drone strikes, specifically one that bestowed on military commanders the power to authorize such strikes in undeclared war zones like Somalia and Yemen without direct permission from the White House. The Biden administration has not yet indicated whether it will revert the Obama-era guidance for strikes or craft a new policy with more robust rules, particularly surrounding the issue of civilian death. Across almost all active U.S. conflicts, we have seen a sharp fall in declared U.S. military actions under Biden, including by drone in Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Yemen, and Libya. Said Chris Woods, director of the British non-governmental organization Air Wars, which tracks U.S. airstrikes and civilian deaths in many nations where the United States is engaged militarily. Woods notes that the strikes were already declining in the latter half of Trump's presidency and that Biden's early moratorium on strikes and his decision thus far to limit their use have greatly reduced civilian deaths at the hands of U.S. forces in several countries. What we don't know yet is if these trends will sustain. Publicly, the administration has yet to articulate its strategy, he said. Privately, we are hearing of the emergence of a hybrid Trump-Obama approach, which, if true, could mean less protections in place for civilians than during the latter part of Obama. That's a worry. spokesperson for the National Security Council did not respond to a request for comment. For years, a core group of mostly progressive members of Congress have steadily sought to find legislative solutions to the excessive secrecy surrounding drone strikes and to make laws requiring more transparency from the Pentagon on civilian casualties. These efforts, which began during Obama's tenure, intensified under Trump, who made clear that he did not care about civilian deaths and, on the campaign trail in 2016, actively encouraged the killing of families of suspected terrorists. They were also a response to a renewed surge beginning in 2018 in civilian deaths in Afghanistan. In 2019, the National Defense Authorization Act established a requirement that a senior civilian within the Department of Defense be empowered to develop, coordinate, and oversee compliance with the policy of the department relating to civilian casualties resulting from United States military operations. Among the duties of this officer would be to develop and disseminate best practices for reducing civilian deaths, to establish a public internet-based mechanism for people to submit allegations of civilian harm, to ensure that the standardized policies were in place for the Pentagon to acknowledge responsibility for death caused by U.S. military operations, and to decide whether to give ex gratia payments to the families of civilians killed as well as to those injured by U.S. operations. The Trump administration has slow-rolled the system's creation and never effectively implemented it. Even before taking office, the Biden campaign had pledged to review the use of drone strikes as part of his counterterrorism approach. Media Benjamin, co-founder of the activist group Code Pink, who has regularly traveled to countries targeted in drone strikes, said, "Drones in particular are an inherently indiscriminate weapon. They have no place in our world. The U.S. should discontinue the use of armed drones and work through the UN for a multilateral treaty to banish them from the face of the earth, in full recognition of U.S. responsibility for unleashing this terror on humanity. There is a campaign to abolish autonomous weapons, but this doesn't go far enough. All drone warfare should be banned." At a minimum, Benjamin said, the Biden administration should immediately restart publishing the monthly air power summaries discontinued by Trump and, in fact, expand them from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria to include all U.S. weapons releases in all countries. They should also be more comprehensive to include all types of aircraft, including helicopters, all branches of the U.S. military and the CIA and other agencies. While Benjamin and other activists have consistently focused on drones, they also recognize that drone strikes represent a small number of total U.S. airstrikes. She points to the latest statistics from Air Wars, which indicate that since Biden took office, there have been 25 U.S. airstrikes in Iraq and 14 in Syria, most of them conducted by conventional aircraft, not drones. In Somalia, according to Air Wars, Biden's 16 strikes to date have already outpaced Obama's average 7.5 per year, though they lag far behind Trump's annual average of 69. Benjamin asserted, so Biden already seems to be conducting twice as many strikes as Obama did in that country, a pattern that very likely holds in other parts of Africa too.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis and elaboration on the thoughts and speeches of the leader of the Muslim Ummah, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Ali and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, brother. And Brother Ali, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Very welcome again to the program, Viewpoints on the speeches and the important points addressed by the leader of Iran and the leader Muslim of the Muslim Ummah, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Today we want to talk about an important topic here and there on different speeches. The leader of Iran addressed about the comprehensiveness of the religion of Islam, that Islam is a religion which can be useful for both the other world and this world. So it covers most of the dimensions and the aspects of the practical life of all the people around the world. So when this statement is posed by some of the defenders of the religion of Islam, that Islam is the most comprehensive religion, it has planned for all the aspects of the lives, it could be discussed from two aspects. Number one is from the side of the intellectuals, I mean, the broad, so-called broad-minded people who are looking for the rational answers to everything. And from the other side, these people who belongs to the Naqli group, or the people who, according to the narrative account, whether it is based on the Holy Quran or Ahadith, can answer this question. First of all, let's get to the rational aspect and how the religion of Islam has answered in order to defend itself.
Yeah.
That I am the comprehensive format and the plan for the life of the people. Okay, I don't know whom to start with, Brother Ali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. There are some reasons that actually we say that Islam is the most comprehensive and the last religion of God. And these reasons can be actually excluded from Quranic or narrative sources. And there are some also reasons that we can bring up through intellectual reasoning. So let me start with the rational, or let's say intellectual reasoning, that proves that that the religion of Islam is the most comprehensive religion.
That's right.
I want to look at some three factors to say that rationally, Quran is a Islam is a comprehensive religion. The first factor is that if we believe that Quran is not comprehensive, actually it is against the intellect itself, because it nullifies the khatamiyyah, or the lastness of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Because if it is not comprehensive, it requires another prophet to come. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us in Quran that he is the last prophet. Secondly, it is against the qa'adatul lutf. I don't know if it can be translated into English, that qa'adatul lutf, that this is the
favor.
The act of mercy or favor.
Act of favor.
Yeah. The act of the rule of favor, which is, let's say, a theological rule.
Yes.
This is a theological rule or term that says that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, actually out of lutf, out of, let's say, out of mercy, actually, in simple words, yes, actually bestows whatever he has to his creatures.
Yes.
The third is that the third, let's say, factor, if we believe that Quran, Islam is not a comprehensive religion, is that it brings us, it brings, let's say, if we believe in Quran at the same time and in the lastness of the Holy Prophet, Khatamiyyah of the Prophet, then the only point that stays is that the Prophet actually was not successful in his message, or in his, let's say, transferring the message to humankind. So we see that, so basically and rationally, we see that these three factors prove that Islam should be a comprehensive religion. Moreover, we can look at Quranic verses and evidences that prove that Islam is a comprehensive religion. How? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Surah An-Naml says that this book answers all the needs of human being.
When we talk about this, we can say aqli part or the rational, it's better to say rational or intellectual part of the religion. We have to first define whose intellect do we mean, Sayyid Mohsen. Because not every intellect or the rational power is capable of understanding the true meaning of the religion of Islam. Is it so? Because for sure we know that the prophets of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the infallible imams had this capacity both in mind and heart in order to, I say, tolerate the pressure of divinity on themselves, okay, do the hazm, I mean, how somehow to have it inside themselves, analyze it, and manifest it through examples to the community and the ummah around. But not every rational and intellect is capable of understanding the very true meaning of the religion of Islam. Is it so or no? We can say any ordinary man, based on his or her understanding, can understand the religion of Islam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When we talk about the intellect, we talk about the pure intellect, which is free of every individual's, you know, we can say, inclinement towards a specific belief
or desire.
When we talk about the intellect, we need to remember that this is a pure intellect. And, for example, when we define the pure intellect, for example, you know, when we take out the intellect from the individual beliefs or inclinements, we see that this pure intellect says lying is a sin. It's a bad habit. For example, this intellect, pure intellect says where we do not have any kind of religion of anything, just based on the intellect, the pure intellect orders that killing someone is a sin.
Yes.
You should not do that. For example, you cannot lie. You cannot fight. Okay, you cannot, you know, destroy the peace of the community in which you are living.
Yes.
So when we talk about the intellect, it's the pure intellect. It's not, for example, the intellect of Einstein or, I don't know, different philosophers that were gone, or the Islamic philosophers. It's not like that.
That's right.
So we talk about the pure term of, or the pure intellect itself. And also we have, like, obviously, this intellect, when we move towards this intellect, then we can find the main religion, the Islam or monotheism.
That's
for example, when we talk about the existence of God, you know, within the philosophies, actually, obviously, in the philosophy, we talk about this pure intellect.
Yes.
So does God exist or not?
Yes.
And then we there, according to the pure intellect, distribute the creatures into different parts.
That's right.
For example, some of them are hadis. Mm-hmm. For example, they were not, and then they became to exist.
Yes.
Now, we know that every single person who exists, or every single entity who exists, has taken his existence from someone else. For example, we were children of our parents, and they were the children,
right.
And it goes on.
That's right.
Similarly, we can see cars, mobile phones, pens, and everything. It's been made by a human being.
Yes.
So basically, everything which exists have an existence from someone else. And
yes.
It keeps going on.
Okay.
Now, when it keeps going on, there should be a stop, like the end,
mm-hmm.
where there is a one who has existence from him own, his own self, and he has given this existence to the others. Otherwise, it will keep continue, and that is void in philosophy. So that end, who was the first who exists and he has his own existence and he has given the existence to the others, we call him God.
That's right.
They can call him a Big Bang. They can call him anything what they
of
want.
Of course, Big Bang is very much different from...
No, I'm just giving an example.
Even the Big Bang,
giving,
that is the creation of the
now,
world...
Now, who did that?
Yes.
Because, you know, we said Allah has created on the rule of cause and effect.
Yes.
What was the cause of this Big Bang?
Yes.
Now, whoever made that cause, we call him God.
Okay.
The last or the final, we can say, like, existence.
That's right.
Who is wajibul wujud, we say, like, yes. in the Arabic terminology, okay. We use the word wajibul wujud,
mm-hmm.
that his existence is necessary.
Yes.
So amongst the being, there is a necessary being and yes. there is a possible being. That necessary being, we call him God, Allah, yes. and we named him. So this is the way how the pure intellect works. So it's not the intellect of a specific philosopher or a specific person.
Mm-hmm.
And when we say that the intellect itself orders, or it tells us, or it takes us towards the towards a religion which is comprehensive, it means this pure intellect, not the general
That's right.
intellect of the people.
And the case is that no Islamic ruling is against the
pure
rational science,
yes.
And it is not against intellect at all,
yes.
because there are complete adjustment between the religion of Islam and the, we can say, the intellectual and the rational parts of the life of the human being.
Even in
but
Islam.
I think the main question is nowadays a little bit distorted and deleted, because they cannot find the answer to so many of the ambiguities they have in mind regarding the presence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala or Islam or religion or something like that. So the best answer is, okay, put all of them aside and let's start from the very material itself.
Why? Because we are trying to think about someone who is unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
Like obviously the
yeah, it cannot
Allah
be, yeah.
is unlimited. With our limited minds.
Yes.
And I want to understand him through my own intellect.
Intellect.
Whereas I need to refer to the pure intellect.
Yes.
So basically the problem is when we try to understand anything through our own intellect, we make mistakes. And that's for sure. It's not just about the God. It's about the other things. It's about the situations. You know, if people are stuck in a specific situation, everyone, according to their own intellect or level of intellectuality, they bring the solutions for it.
That's right.
You know, but the point is when you join all the ideas and you take it to the level of the pure intellect, that's the way you find the best
right.
way out of
okay.
that situation.
That's right.
So it's totally depends on our own thinking and our own, you know, the way we brought up the
mm-hmm.
society where we have all these things have effects on our own intellect, not the pure ones.
That's right. Nowadays, the neurosciences, I mean the brain ones, mm-hmm. are working very much. What are the centers of the feelings, sadness, happiness, pleasure, even religion in your brain and mind, okay?
Yeah.
They are still searching a lot based on their, we can say, talents. I mean the scientific potentials that they have, they're working on that. But this pure intellect and the rational that we are talking about, for sure itself has root in spirituality, something which is beyond both the mind and the heart, okay? And this is, I think, very important in order to be taken into account. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints regarding the comprehensive aspects of the religion of Islam in both aspects, the rational and narrative dimensions we try to discuss it. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you to doubt you would be the worst mistake? Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest night, shows me right from wrong, in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life, but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need.
are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. Recent scientific research has found that by 2050, the key drivers of major climate change will be feedback loops at both ends of the temperature spectrum. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Alfred W. McCoy, writer. This article is published under the heading, Melting of Ice Sheets is Dramatic, but Melting of Permafrost Means Mass Death. Stay tuned for more. When midnight strikes on New Year's Day of 2050, there will be little cause for celebration. But for most of humanity, it will just be another day of adversity bordering on misery, a desperate struggle to find food, water, shelter, and safety. In the previous decades, storm surges will have swept away coastal barriers erected at enormous cost, and rising seas will have flooded the downtowns of major cities that once housed more than 100 million people. Relentless waves will pound shorelines around the world, putting villages, towns, and cities at risk. As several hundred million climate change refugees in Africa, Latin America, and South Asia feel leaky boats or trash overland in a desperate search for food and shelter, affluent nations worldwide will be trying to shut their borders even tighter, pushing crowds back in tear gas and gunfire. Yet those reluctant host countries, including the United States, won't faintly be immune from the pain. Every summer, in fact, ever more powerful hurricanes propelled by climate change will pummel the East and U.S. Gulf Coast of this country, possibly even forcing the federal government to abandon Miami and New Orleans to the rising tides. Meanwhile, wildfires, already growing in size in 2021, will devastate vast stretches of the West, destroying thousands upon thousands of homes every summer and fall in an ever-expanding fire season. This dismal vision of life circa 2050 comes not from some flight of literary fantasy, but from published environmental science. Indeed, we can all see the troubling signs of global warming around us right now, worsening wildfires, ever more severe ocean storms, and increased coastal flooding. While the world is focused on the fiery spectacle of wildfires destroying swathes of Australia, Brazil, California, and Canada, a far more serious threat is developing, only half attended to. In the planet's remote polar regions, not only are the ice caps melting with frightening speed, already raising sea levels worldwide, but the vast Arctic permafrost is fast receding, releasing enormous stores of lethal greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. At that frozen frontier far beyond our ken or consciousness, ecological changes brewing largely invisibly deep beneath the Arctic tundra will accelerate global warming in the ways sure to inflict untold future misery on all of us. More than any of other place or problem, the thawing of Arctic frozen earth, which covers vast parts of the roof of the world, will shape humanity's fate for the rest of the century, destroying cities, devastating nations, and rupturing the current global order. In assessing the likely course of climate change by 2050, one question is paramount. How quickly will we feel its impact? For decades, scientists thought that climate change would arrive at what science writer Eugene Linden called stately pace. In 1975, the U.S. National Academies of Sciences still felt that it would take centuries for the climate to change in a meaningful way. As late as 1990, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, concluded that the Arctic permafrost, which stores both the staggering amounts of carbon dioxide, CO2, and methane, an even more dangerous greenhouse gas, was not yet melting and that the Antarctic ice sheets remained stable. In 1993, however, scientists began studying ice cores extracted from Greenland's ice cap and found that there had been 25 rapid climate change events in the last glacial period thousands of years ago, showing that the climate could change massively within a decade or two. Driven by a growing scientific consensus about the dangers facing humanity, representatives of 196 states met in 2015 in Paris, where they agreed to commit themselves to a 45% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 and achieve net carbon neutrality by 2050 to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. This, they argued, would be sufficient to avoid the disastrous impacts sure to come at 2 degrees Celsius degrees or higher. However, the bright hopes of that Paris conference faded quickly. Within 3 years, the scientific community realized that the cascading effects of global warming reaching 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels would be evident not in the distant future of 2100, but perhaps by 2040, impacting most adults alive today. The medium-term effects of climate change will only be amplified by the uneven way the planet is warming, with a far heavier impact in the Arctic. According to a Washington Post analysis, by 2018, the world already had hot spots that had recorded an average rise of 2 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial norm. As the sun strikes tropical latitudes, huge columns of warm air rise and then are pushed toward the poles by greenhouse gases trapped in the atmosphere until they drop down to Earth at higher latitudes, creating spots with faster rising temperatures in the West Asia region, Western Europe, and above all, the Arctic. In a 2018 IPCC Doomsday report, its scientists warned that even at just 1.5 degrees Celsius, temperature increases would be unevenly distributed globally and could possibly reach a devastating 4.5 degrees Celsius in the Arctic high altitudes, with profound consequences for the entire planet. Recent scientific research has found that by 2050, the key drivers of major climate change will be feedback loops at both ends of the temperature spectrum. At the hotter end in Africa, Australia, and the Amazon, warmer temperatures will spark ever more devastating forest fires, reducing tree cover and releasing vast amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. This in turn, as is already happening, will fuel yet more fires and so create a monstrous self-reinforcing feedback loop that could decimate the great tropical rainforests of this planet. The even more serious and uncontrollable driver, however, will be in the planet's polar regions. There, an Arctic feedback loop is already gaining a self-sustaining momentum that could soon move beyond humanity's capacity to control it. By mid-century or before, as ice sheets continue to melt disastrously in Greenland and Antarctica, rising oceans will make extreme sea level events like once-in-a-century storm surges and flooding annual occurrences in many areas. If global warming grows beyond the maximum 2 degrees Celsius target set by the Paris Agreement, depending on what happens to Antarctica's ice sheets, ocean levels could increase by a staggering 43 inches as this century ends. In fact, a worst-case scenario by the National Academies of Sciences projects a sea level rise of as much as 20 inches by 2050 and 78 inches in 2100, with a catastrophic loss of 690,000 square miles of land and expanse 4 times the size of California, displacing about 2.5% of the world's population and inundating major cities like New York. Adding to such concerns, a recent study in Nature predicted that by 2060, rain rather than snow could dominate parts of the Arctic, further accelerating ice loss and raising sea levels significantly. Moving that doomsday ever closer, recent satellite imagery reveals that the ice shelf holding back Antarctica's massive De Weisse Glacier could shatter within 3 to 5 years, quickly breaking that Florida-sized frozen mass into hundreds of icebergs and eventually resulting in several feet of sea level rise on its own.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.